This episode is brought to you by Tillet, the style leader in hospitality workwear and hotel and restaurant uniforms. Learn more at tilletnyc.com. Meet and Three is back. We're kicking off our fourth season and celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary with a very special episode about our home, Brooklyn.
Roberta's was such an interesting place with such a strong gravitational pull. It attracted all these different groups.
The neighborhood has changed a lot over the past decade, from its culinary renaissance to the complicated implications of gentrification.
I would say the majority of the people who are members of our co-op definitely have a certain purchasing power, are mostly white, and we are trying to change that.
We're taking you on a journey that spans the birthplace of food radio to buzzy neighborhood pollinators to the transformative health journey of our borough president.
That was my moment of, you know, wow, someone has thrown me a life raft and I'm going to take it.
Subscribe to Meet and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey gang, just a quick reminder, the Food Media Lab is just about a month away. It takes place in San Francisco, California, at the San Francisco Cooking School, June 17th, 18th, and 19th. I will be co-teaching a class on podcasting and doing a live presentation of this show on the Tuesday night of the conference, January 18th, from 7 to 9 p.m. For information and tickets, visit thefoodmedialab.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
If you would have asked me 10 years ago, I would have answered this question completely different, because I probably would have, if you walk in the door 10 years ago and I would be chef here, I probably would give you 10 courses and like we'll send you out an explanation for every course and, you know, possibly put as many ingredients on the plate as I can to show you how good or how better of a cook I am. Mm-hmm. But now, for me, it's not just the cooking part of it. For me, it's the restaurant, which I enjoy about New York. Is like, let's get back to the idea of a restaurant. And what's the idea of a restaurant? That people feel well, that people can speak to their, you know, dining companion, that they, it's not all about the chef, it's not mm-hmm. all about the sommelier, but with still having the quality on the plate and the wine in the glass.
That is Chef Marcus Glocker of Batard and Augustine Restaurants in Lower Manhattan, our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I'm your host, Andrew Friedman. And for the first time in about 3 weeks, I'm not with Caitlin. I am with Jose Arroyo. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Jose Arroyo.
Arroyo.
I do not take any fault. My last name is hard to pronounce. You got to roll the R's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Usually I go with Jose Arroyo.
Okay.
I Americanize it a little bit.
You take the the salsa out of it.
I do. Yes.
Okay. So, for people who are wondering, Jose is a guest who we just recorded an interview. I'm going to air it in the next, I don't know, week or two, and you'll get his whole story then. But I asked him if he would spend another few minutes with me and jump in and do an intro with me, because as longtime listeners know, I like to have someone here with me.
He does.
For the intro.
And he's too hard on himself.
Thank you.
No problem.
Jose's becoming my life coach as we sit here. I'm in Los Angeles. The LA Chef Conference was this week. We're going to have a special package from that that's going to drop probably next week. But I'm sitting on the beach.
Gorgeous.
In Santa Monica. The ocean is within view. We're right on the edge of the beach on a bench.
Beautiful weather,
We did
too.
An interview here. We got a couple of comments from the Peanut Gallery, which people can hear next week. Some passersby offered some feedback. That was kind of that made me feel like I was home, actually. That was kind of a New York moment here in,
you know, we
Santa
we have
Monica.
Interesting characters here in California too, Andrew. Don't worry about that. We got them too.
So, Jose, so my guest on this show, it's a single interview this week, is Marcus Glocker. Now, Marcus is the chef of, for 5 years now, Batard Restaurant in New York City. And for people who don't know, Batard is in a historic restaurant location. Drew Naporant, who's a very influential restaurateur, had his first restaurant as owner in that space. It was Montrachet, which is also the restaurant where David Boulay became very famous. And then he had a restaurant there called Cortone with a chef by the name of Paul Liebrandt. That was sort of an ill-fated relationship. That's no big secret, but that didn't last that long, although the restaurant was terrific, had two Michelin stars. And then Drew partnered with a front-of-house guy named John Winterman and Chef Marcus Glocker, who's our guest.
I love all the accolades. I love how all these people just have, it's like accolade after accolade.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
You like that?
It's like a badge of honor.
Does it mean something to you?
It does mean something. I think if you're in the industry and you care,
yeah,
you get it. You're like, it's like
a house, like the good housekeeping.
Yeah, in the military we have these, you know, it's like, oh, this guy is airborne. He's you know, you just build these different accolades. Like you see someone with a lot of patches, you're like, okay, that guy, he's somebody.
All right, well, these guys have a lot of patches.
Yeah, they do. They do.
So anyway, Drew Naporant and John Winterman and Marcus recreated the space as Batard. Okay. It's about to celebrate its fifth anniversary.
Congratulations to them.
And I wanted to sit down with Marcus, who's a super nice guy who I just don't know well. We see each other around, and this was kind of the first real conversation we had was the interview I'm about to run. I do want to let people know that Batard's anniversary is going to be commemorated on Sunday, June 2nd. Which is about 10 days after this episode drops, maybe 11 days. They are having a party at the restaurant. It starts in the late morning, I believe 11:30 a.m., and runs for a few hours. And it is a benefit for City Harvest, which is a terrific charitable organization.
I've heard a lot about them, actually.
And, you know, the ticket's only, forgive me, guys, I hope I'm getting this right, I think it's a $40 ticket. But if you want to be...
It's like two movie tickets now.
But you can get an extra generous ticket, which is $50. And it's just, you're just giving some more to a good charity. Yeah. It's still pretty reasonable to come and eat and drink at Batard.
Yeah, definitely do that. Be a good person.
So I am going to, you know, the ticket's available on Eventbrite. And it's kind of a long address to say on the air. No one's going to remember it. So I'm just going to say... You could go to eventbrite.com and you can search there, and you could search for City Harvest events in New York, and it will come up. Or I'm going to put it in the stack of links that are linked to in the bio of my Instagram feed. So the Instagram handle for this show is at Chef Podcast.
Just look below.
If you go there, click on the link in the bio, and that will people have. Not many people have seen this, but I use it's called Hypolink.
Okay.
So if you click that link, it takes you to a page that has just a stack of links, and I will put this one near the top. Okay. Nice. So that'll take you if you want to buy a ticket. I'm going to be there. So extra bonus for those of you who want to say hello to me, I'll be there for at least part of the day. I'm rushing back from a wedding out of state to attend that party.
Yeah, come see Andrew. He'll sign something.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Gosh, you're such a good fan. Okay. What else can I tell the people about Marcus Glocker, Jose? What do you want to know about Marcus before the interview? Oh, I know. He's at another restaurant as well. So he's doing double duty. In addition to being the chef of Batard, he is the chef of Augustine, the new chef there, which is a Keith McNally property in Lower Manhattan.
Okay.
So he's got his hands full. He's going back and forth.
He's a busy man.
Yeah, but he is one of these. He worked for Gordon Ramsay early in his career. He worked for Charlie Trotter.
Big fan.
Of Gordon?
Gordon Ramsay.
You're a big fan?
A big fan.
Now, this is interesting.
Yeah.
Because you're a young guy. You're 30. Mm. And most people your age know him as the screaming chef on television. Mm-hmm. Do you like that?
No, I think when I started watching him, he was I watched that like Beyond Boiling Point with Gordon Ramsay years ago on
that
the
was
BBC.
His old show, yeah.
Oh my God,
yeah, I but that it. Was kind of a traditional
well,
show.
Well, because that was to me, it's like that's like the realest Gordon Ramsay. You know, right. If you're gonna run a Michelin star restaurant at the time, that's how you ran it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
not saying that that's how you should run it anymore.
I
feel
understand.
Like things have changed, but it's nice to see.
You thought that was an honest depiction.
Yeah, it's an honest depiction. Yeah. And all the stuff he does now, I mean, come on. He's just doing, he's got to get that money.
It's a shtick. You know?
That's all right.
I agree. Anyway, but Marcus worked for Gordon. He worked for the late Charlie Trotter.
Yeah.
And you meet him and he's very, like, put together. And, I mean, he's just one of these people who, you know, I think if I was somebody like Drew Naporant or somebody like John looking for a partner, Marcus just seems completely buttoned down, in
put
control,
together.
Put together. He's worked in some old-style kitchens, and pretty much can do, I think, anything with food, you know. And I love, I have not been to Augustine since he took over, but I love Batard. Absolutely love it. We met in the morning there on a Monday, beginning of the work week. And
much like today?
Much like today. Well, this is a Tuesday, though.
It is a Tuesday.
But we sat down and did an interview right there in the, you know, in the dining room in the morning. And I think that's all I'm going to say about it.
Awesome.
So with that, here is my interview with Chef Marcus Glocker of Batard and Augustine. Here you go. Are you off on Sundays? Do you follow that old school schedule?
Normally, I take Sundays off, yes.
Yeah.
That's my day. But yesterday, I did like a Games of Thrones dinner as well.
So, yeah.
With City Harvest, actually. And,
oh, okay.
Which was fun.
Nice. Was that like an auction thing?
Or? It was an auction thing, yeah. And it was cooking for six people with wine pairing, six courses.
Nice.
So it was a nice, nice dinner.
Okay. So, first of all, can I just ask, you're back and forth these days between two places.
Correct. So I took on another project, which is the Augustine restaurant at the Beekman Hotel, which is actually owned by Keith McNally. And I just took this on in September.
Yeah.
And I just revamped the menu.
Yeah.
It's going to be a little bit more like Austrian, like Vienna meets Paris. That's sort of the theme there. So it's a very, very simple, classic French-Austrian cuisine.
Mm-hmm. You like cooking in that style?
I do. I think Batard is a little bit, I would say, a little bit more refined. Mm-hmm. So certain things or certain dishes I won't be able to cook here.
Sure.
But I like the space down there, and I think it's a beautiful restaurant. And when I walked in there, I thought, this is great. It's made for that type of food.
You grew up in Austria.
Correct. Outside of Linz, actually. Mm-hmm. A small city or village. It's called Gallneukirchen. Very small.
What's very small?
I mean, the biggest city is like 5,000, and then we have, in the village I live, is about 400 people living there. So
okay.
New York is a big step for me.
But am I correct? Your family was in the hotel business?
Yes. My sister's mom, she married a man back in a time who had a beautiful farmhouse on a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And when they started their marriage there, they actually redeveloped this farmhouse into a hotel.
Okay.
And it's really classic, as you can picture it in Austria, on the mountain, a couple of cows around, you know, snow. That's that type of thing. And they had no kids, so I actually was supposed to take this place over when I was 18, but I just basically bounced.
That seemed a little too isolated for you?
Yes, absolutely. And I really wanted to, I wanted to see something. I wanted to learn something. I didn't want to be just doing the same thing over and over.
Can you tell me about that setting for a minute? What, I mean, who came there to that hotel, and how big a property was it?
I mean, the property had about 60 rooms.
In the main house. Yeah.
And then there was like a restaurant, which is, it's like one main restaurant. It's not like an a la carte type of thing. It's it's really like groups of people come there, and they have like, you know, five, six different dishes.
Yeah.
So that was about, we could see it's about 200 people.
Wow.
And then you had like a small little restaurant next to it as well, which was like more the a la carte type of thing, not a 40. And then they built on another house to it, which had another couple guest rooms, but no F&B. But, you know, you had basically my grandfather was manning the bar.
Okay.
It was a family affair.
He was doing it
till he was like 85 years old. He was still behind the bar and like, you know, entertaining the locals.
Yeah.
That was great. My aunt was in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Is in the kitchen still. You know, it's pretty amazing when you look back. 200 people. They had three people in the kitchen.
Oh, my God.
Obviously, that food was not that high-end, but, you know, it's still, it's a lot of mise en
place. Still, that's a lot of...
All the cakes were made in-house, you know, schnitzel, roast pork, that classic Austrian fare. But, you know, when you do 200 people and they're coming at once,
right?
She pulled it off, and that was sort of interesting. It
sounds like you come from a family of hard workers.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Was that sort of ingrained in you as a child, like a work ethic?
Yes, I mean...
Yeah.
I'm not coming from money, so my dad was like, you know, raising four kids and did everything he could to support us, and he did a fantastic job, I would say.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he told us as well, like, you know, you want to have certain things in life, you have to work for it. Mm-hmm. And on the school holidays, we went up to the hotel, you know, helped out my family there a little bit, and, you know, we made some extra bucks, and, you know, we could afford certain things, but you had to work for it.
When you started as a kid cooking, did you you liked it, but did you have a natural, do you feel like you had a natural aptitude for it? Like, do you feel like you had, you picked things up quickly, that your hands, you had good hands for this kind of work?
I was very good in observing, I would say.
Observing.
I didn't even want to go into the field of cooking. I wanted to be actually front of house. That was my original idea of I did the apprenticeship for back of house and front of house together.
Yeah.
But I was always intrigued by the old school London hotels, you know, like butler service, that type of thing. Uh-huh. That was my original idea of what I wanted to do. But then when I first started cooking and actually went into the first professional kitchen, then I sort of started liking it, and I saw the chefs, how they handle food and products. So I was observing that, and I didn't say much at that time, but, you know, I still remember certain movements of chefs, like the way they touch the products, the way they handle it still to this day. Like on my first commis position in Munich, when I looked at Andreas Meyer when he was like cooking.
Yeah.
So those things, it was very good. And obviously practice after yeah. that. But I learned to love it.
You gravitated before you found your way to New York to a lot of very, kind of iconic chefs and restaurants. You spent time with Gordon Ramsay.
I did, yeah.
And you spent time with Charlie Trotter, which I want to talk about both of those. But coming from where you came from, you just said yourself, you know, you came from a place where the food wasn't at that, I don't even like to say that level. It's a different style.
It's a different style, yeah, absolutely.
What drew you to these places that really, in a lot of ways, were about as demanding as it gets?
I mean, I was reading every magazine, every book back in the time which came out. You know, the Feinschmecker in Germany was like this magazine everybody was in, and you saw Gordon Ramsay back in the 90s on the cover. So obviously, there was sort of a rock and roll type of thing as well as for chefs. But I always had a clear vision of what I wanted to learn. For me, it was not about just going to Gordon Ramsay because it's Gordon Ramsay or Charlie Trotter. I saw Charlie's books. I wanted to learn that style.
Yeah.
I wanted to go to Ramsay because everybody told me if you make it a year there, you're going to be, you know, tough enough to do the next step because, you know, we worked 18 hours a day there. You know, it was a demanding kitchen.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the other part I wanted to learn too. Creativity at Gordon Ramsay, I wouldn't say I went there for this reason.
Yeah.
I went there for the overall how to run a restaurant. But this was the clear vision steps for me to go from one restaurant to another restaurant. But again, the classic way of leaving Austria and going into the world was always like, you go to Germany, you go to London, and if you're going to make the step to America, was unheard of normally because it was very tough to do that. But normally then people went to Switzerland and maybe came back home and took over their own hotels.
Right. So you go to work for Gordon. Can I ask, what year was that you went to work for him?
Gordon Ramsay was, I think it was 2003.
Okay.
2003 in London. Okay.
So we need to just set this up. For people who are younger, who only know him from television, Gordon Ramsay, there's a direct line from him to Marco Pierre White.
Absolutely.
If you look at the book White Heat, which was a very important book, Gordon is in some of the pictures in that book. If you look at Marco's old BBC television show, Marco Cooks.
He's in there.
He's in the kitchen. He's one of the blokes in the kitchen.
Absolutely.
And he was, I mean, he's one of the most talented chefs probably in the world. And at the time you're talking about was peak Gordon Ramsay.
He had one show which was Boiling Point at that time,
okay.
which was a very old school show, but this was from Hospital Road when he opened up.
Yeah.
But besides that, it was he got 3 stars at Hospital Road, and then he opened Gordon Ramsay at Claridge's.
Mm-hmm.
And I was part of the opening team there with Josh Emmett and a couple other of his main guys. And obviously now, actually, Love in Madison Park is taking over the same property, which is quite impressive. I think it's one of the most amazing and iconic hotels in London,
mm-hmm.
and to be a part of this opening team was stunning. And you know, Gordon was in the kitchen. There was six sous chefs on front on the pass to check every single item which went out there for an opening. And if something went wrong, they went back to the station, actually took over the station and cooked.
Mm-hmm.
So to be a part of an opening and the way he opened a restaurant with that pressure as well, it was pretty amazing to see.
How was it? What was the process like of getting hired into that kitchen?
My process was I flew to London. I knocked on a few doors. Actually, my first interview at Claridge's was actually on the hotel side of it.
Okay.
And I didn't even know that Gordon Ramsay was opening there.
Okay.
And I was talking to the chef there, and I wasn't quite interested in working on the hotel side of it because mm-hmm. I was in Munich and did that part of it before. So I just walked in the front door of Gordon Ramsay Claridge's. They weren't open yet. A gentleman called Josh Emmett was the sous chef at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He greeted me, and I said, like, come back next week. So I flew back next week and did a stage there for one day, and I got hired.
Really?
That was the process.
Okay, but you said you were part of the opening team.
Yes, I mean, they were already doing menu testing and everything. So they just put me.
So
in
they
the,
put you to work yeah, to yeah. see how you if you had the goods.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. And okay, I'm not. I know Gordon is a tough guy, so I'm not asking for like dirt, right?
No.
But what was it like to be in that kitchen? What was it like working for Gordon Ramsay in those days?
I enjoyed it. I have to really say, I still think I had one of the most amazing experiences there
because why?
Of the attitude of the whole team. I think it's you know, Gordon is Gordon, but I think the team you worked with in that mm-hmm. kitchen, that's sort of like, it's just, we were so close because we worked literally 18 hours a day mm-hmm. and we were not stopping. We were running with 20-minute break that was from 5 to 5:20. At 5:30 you had to be ready. If you were able to take the break, you got lucky, and if not, you had to walk through. But I'm not even want to make this about like how hard it is to work in a kitchen because yeah. everybody gives you those stories. But I was pretty amazed by the workload and when you're really organized in a kitchen, what you can achieve as one person, one station. Just to give an example on a meat station, for example, you have 6 to 7 different dishes on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
There's no butcher in the morning who does the sauces and butchering for you. It's all you. So you walk in at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
Your produce is coming in. If the produce is 10 to 15 minutes late, your schedule is already thrown off for the whole day. So all this was so drastically organized. So by the time the bones and the chickens came in, you were running. You had like the pots already secured because you didn't want to make sure you have your pots for all the sauces.
Yeah.
So you made 5 sauces. You butchered all the meat. By lunch service, you had to be ready with pretty much 50, 60% of the mise en place. Do lunch service. Lunch service took till 3:30. So at 5:30, you reopened for dinner service.
Mm-hmm.
And Claridge's was not a small restaurant. Claridge's was, we did, you know, average 100 for lunch. And then mm-hmm. for dinner, you did about 120, 130
mm-hmm.
for one person on a meat station. To do this now, you need probably like 3 people
right.
to shift it out, you know?
Yeah.
But it was one person. And you work 10 to 12 days straight sometimes.
Yeah.
So you was not the only person. Everybody in this kitchen did that. And the teamwork was tremendous.
You're describing a very old school way of doing things. Not just the workload, but this notion that the same person who's going to be cooking your dish for service probably butchered the fish or the
Absolutely.
Meat earlier in the day, probably prepped the vet. Basically, you are responsible for your dishes, right? And I've heard you speak very positively about the impact that has on the actual plate, on what comes out. How does somebody doing their own, you know, prep work, their own butchery, all that, how is that reflected in the final dish in a way that might not be obvious to me? Even to me, that doesn't seem, I'm not challenging it,
yeah.
but it doesn't seem obvious to me why that would make a difference.
I mean, I think, personally, I think when you open the kitchen in the morning and you're going to be there the whole day, and I'm talking hypothetically now because obviously in this day and age, you cannot, by law, you can't do this anymore,
sure.
first of all.
Yeah.
And I think a restaurateur cannot afford that way of mm-hmm. paying an employee anymore. But, you know, you're going to open up, you know exactly what's in your fridge, you know exactly what's coming in. I mean, you have to label everything, but you probably know exactly how old or how young anything
yeah.
is in the fridge.
Yeah.
So when you butcher all this and you make the sauce for this, I think you own the dish in a different way as well. You are proud of it. You will not get anything to waste. You know how much work you put into it.
Mm.
This is just a whole psychological
Way
of thinking at one dish.
And ownership.
The ownership is a big part of cooking. And when you create a dish yourself and you put it on the menu and somebody else makes this dish for you and you're at the pass, you're plating this dish on the pass and you see 5 things wrong, it's going to affect you differently than the 5 things the other person sees wrong because you created this dish and
right.
you put the thought process in
yeah.
the work. So I think that's a big step. When I opened Batard here with John Winterman and Drew, I have to say I did the same thing. Drew was, you're crazy, but I wanted to have the same people doing the butchering, the sauces in the morning.
Yeah.
And we did service as well. Obviously, it was a very expensive opening, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
But the interesting part was that I think there was a big big moment for us all, because there was a team. We knew every dish. We knew all the mise en place every day. Everything came in. So there was not like I had to ask five times, "How? Where is this from? Why is this here?" Everybody knew what's going on in the kitchen. So it was a fairly smooth opening, I would say.
Yeah. There's a line that I heard once in a screenwriting seminar, which was, a writer knows his world the way God knows his world, right? And I feel like that's how it is with chefs and kitchens. Like, a part of being a great chef, is it not? It sounds mundane, but when you describe having this intimate knowledge of what's in the fridge, what's coming in, what's, you know, how long has it been there? That's step one.
I mean, kudos to Gordon Ramsay. I mean, he was the first guy in the kitchen I've ever seen this process when I was in my young years, you know?
Yeah.
If a sous chef was shouting at a cook on a station back in the time,
yeah,
Gordon was actually defending the line cook and said to the sous chef, "Did you actually check the fridge today? Do you know what's in this fridge? Did you do that? You cannot just do that, you know? If he does something wrong, yes, that's one thing, but it's your responsibility that you're going to go before service through every fridge and know what's going on.
Yeah.
If you don't do that and you don't catch those mistakes already when we start service, you cannot...
Then you don't really have control of your own kitchen.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that as well, because if you know what's in the fridge of every single station, you can catch so many things beforehand already, which is unnecessary missteps during service.
Yeah.
And cooking during service is stressful enough.
Yeah,
but if you miss something or forget something or items are missing, that's something to really, it's hardly you can pick this up during service.
Yeah, so I need to ask this. You know, somebody who comes up in the geographical way you came up and the kitchens you came up in, I'm always amazed that, not so much right now, but I'm always amazed that you would want to come to the United States, given the reputation this country had historically had in terms of cuisine, certainly fine dining, right? It didn't have the respect it commands today even. But what made you want to come here?
I mean, Charlie Trotter, Thomas Keller, those chefs for me were...
It was chef-specific.
Chef-specific. I wanted to see what they do.
Yeah.
French Laundry Cookbook was one of those books when it came out. I looked at it, and you know, I knew some people. They worked there as well. So it was a dream. I mean, a dream became a reality.
And, interesting.
And when I had the chance to go to Chicago, and I specifically wanted to go there, and you know, I had to fly three times over to Chicago. You have to imagine this. For a stage at Charlie Trotter's, because Matt Merges, I'm sure you know him, he was the chef de cuisine at that time, and they sort of didn't really believe that I really want to 100% do this, you know, coming over to the United States, because obviously paperwork, visa, it's a lot of.
It was Matthias who had the doubt.
Yeah, Matthias was there at that time as a sous chef, as a chef de cuisine, and then you know, Giuseppe D'Antoni, Bill Kim, all these people in the kitchen.
Yeah,
and I flew three times over. My dad thought I'm...
To do three different trails?
Trails, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
To fly over there and do this. And my dad said, are you crazy? I mean, why are you doing this? You know, I used all my money I saved up to fly over here. Anyway, long story short, I mean, it was the biggest move I did, and I think the most important move I did as well.
Mm.
And I met people like, you know, the Family Jones at Chef's Garden, flying out there, looking at this produce. I mean, I don't think at that time there was anything cooler in the whole world to see that garden and that precision of growing vegetables.
Yeah.
And I was just excited about it, to see this and be a part of this.
Just so people know, Lee Jones, he goes as Farmer Lee Jones. It's the Chef Garden in Milan, Ohio. People in the industry, if you don't think you know him, you probably do. He wears the same outfit everywhere. It's blue overalls, a white dress shirt, and a red bow tie. And that's his... That's his uniform.
It's his uniform. It's brand new.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's who Lee Jones is. But you're talking about, well, not the earliest days of that, but when he was still sort of on the upswing. Yeah, and Charlie was a huge supporter of that for
Charlie was a huge supporter. I mean, I remember Charlie said to me, we're going to go to Chef's Garden. And I said, like, wow, we're going to go to Chef's Garden. Where is it? So so we flew out there, and that was the first lunch Charlie did for Fer and Adria.
Uh-huh.
That I remember this was I think 14 courses, organ meats only and vegetables.
Oh my gosh.
For lunch. And it was, I think it was 24 people.
Okay.
And he took me there with Matthias Merges, and we cooked there. And for me, the way of doing things was a little bit different than in Europe, because the creativity was differently opened up to young chefs than mm-hmm. it was in Europe. Because in Europe you had the recipe, and when you work in high-end kitchens, you did this, you followed through, you did it right, was fine. The level of creativity and like allowing some people as well to make some mistakes in some capacity was something I've never seen. And mm-hmm. when I worked at Charlie's Kitchen, to say like, yeah, make a dish, make something nice, use that, use this. Even if it was not going on the menu right away, he gave you this freedom a little bit.
He give you feedback?
Of course, absolutely. Yeah. And Matt was the main person in that perspective to sort of, you know, get this out of you, get the creativity out of you. What can we use from you for the restaurant? What can we give from the restaurant to you as well? But it was always like a connection about cultural techniques as well. I had to bring something to the table.
Mm-hmm.
How they're going to use it is different. But, mm-hmm. you know, I had to open myself up to anything.
Yeah. Can you just speak for a minute? You said the books were a big thing. Keller's book was a big thing for you and Charlie's books. I just spent some time actually for an article going through Charlie's, the ones that were organized by type of food, right? Vegetable, meat and game, seafood. The photography. I'm sure they had to be for a young chef
at this time.
Yeah,
it was. I think it was one of the coolest books you can get.
So can you just speak for a second? Because you're right on the cusp when it all started in a big way, not entirely, but to switch, right, from books to Netflix, YouTube, right?
Correct, yeah.
You're right on the line between guys who looked to books and had this other, you know, more active medium available. Can you just speak to what books meant to you as a young cook coming up?
I mean, books was for me a collectible. I mean, anything I bought with the money I made in that time was literally cookbooks.
Yeah.
I had no other ideas to spend it, or go out to dinner and then save up and eat in another restaurant to check it out. But a book for me is something, you have something in your hand. It's just like, you know, you can take it out anytime you want and then you look at it again and reread it. And it's inspiring. And that's really something I still do to this day.
Yeah.
Books are maybe in a different way. Cookbooks in this day and age is maybe not necessary as like the recipe book, for example, but visually to look at it and open it up. I think it's a big factor as a chef to see like, okay, this is a dish, the colors are great. You look at it, you're not even talking about the flavors or taste, you're just talking about the visual aspect of it. And yeah, you can do it on Instagram, you can do it on Facebook, that's all great. But physically to open a book mm-hmm. and see the chef in front and see what his style is.
Yeah.
It means a lot to me still.
It does. I think that's the thing a lot of people misunderstand, right? Because people forever, I think, were looking at these chef cookbooks, especially the ones that came out in the 90s. That's mm-hmm. when Charlie did a lot of his books. Keller's book, the French Laundry book, was 99. Marco Pierre White's White Heat was 90. I think people look at those books and think, especially Trotter's books, right? Those recipes are great. There's so much work, you know? It's like 6-7 recipes maybe for one dish. But I think for most professionals who look at it, like you just said, it's not that you're going to make it. It's about inspiration.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So pushing boundaries and at that time.
So how long did you stay there?
I was almost 2 years.
Okay.
Almost, yeah. The visa was about 18 months, and then I stayed a little bit longer, and yeah, I went back.
Okay.
Visa was up, went back to Vienna. And then I started working for a gentleman called Heinz Reitbauer mm-hmm. at restaurant Steyrek in mm-hmm. Vienna. Which was another fantastic experience. I was just there like 3 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah? What was it? There. Oh, yeah. This was all over your Instagram.
Yeah. I mean, Reitbauer family is like an inspirational family, too. It's like they had a restaurant in Vienna for many, many years. And it was sort of the number one restaurant, or is the number one restaurant anyway, in Vienna. But it was in a different location, and then they purchased a building in the middle of Stadtpark mm-hmm. In Vienna. And it used to be an old milk house back in the time, where
right.
people really literally go there and pick up the milk to bring home. And they took over this house, put a restaurant on top, a little bit more casual cheese, and a casual restaurant with a variety of cheese. I think it's one of the biggest selections of cheese in whole Austria.
Mm-hmm.
And on top they have a little garden. And I would say he's very similar to, you know, Blue Hill Stone Barns, that type of vibe. He's growing his own vegetables. He tries to get new species of vegetables. So he's very influential, very creative.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the chance to work with him, and he was 34 years old when he took it over. And he took over the family restaurant, basically. He was working at Alois Chapelle before.
Okay.
And, you know, everybody looks at a young chef very critical in Austria, like anywhere else. And, you know, he had a few dishes he put on himself, a couple of old dishes which were from the restaurant before. But by now, the last, I would say, 10 years, he was just, like, creating his own style. Absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm. So you're there for how long?
I was there for almost a year before I got the visa again to go to New York.
Yeah, and that was to work with Gordon Ramsay again.
And then we opened Gordon Ramsay at the London Hotel, yes.
Yeah.
It's a different chapter, yes. I was there as a sous chef at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a whole different aspect. It was 560 rooms, F&B, huge private dining.
You had
two-star restaurant, you had Maze by Gordon Ramsay. So it was a huge F&B outlet with about 80 cooks in the kitchen.
Oh, my gosh.
The kitchen was one whole kitchen, but it was divided into service kitchens. It was the biggest thing, the biggest restaurant I ever was part of for an opening. We went through some hoops and troubles there, for sure. But it was a great learning curve as well, and I had the chance to take that kitchen over in 2010 it was, when Gordon sold actually his shares off. And I carried on taking care mainly of the fine dining restaurant there, which was sort of a jewel in there in this building. And I really enjoyed myself there because it was a classic European restaurant in New York City, in Midtown. However, you know, I did 7 years there, and I wanted to...
Long time.
I wanted to break away from that type of... setting, and now we're here at Petard.
Had you ever been here before you moved here?
No. I was one time here for a two-day visit when I lived in Chicago, but that doesn't count.
That was it. So what was your indoctrination to life as a New Yorker like? How was it, easier or harder than you thought it would be, or both?
It was harder. It was definitely harder.
I
think nothing can prepare you for New York. I think it's, you say, you lived in big cities, that's great, but when you really stand there with two suitcases full of your belongings, and I was 26 years old at the time, and standing on 54th Street and looking where this hotel is, where Gordon Ramsay is opening, and you have all your belongings with you. I was living with a guy on 185th Street.
Okay.
I remember that.
On the west side?
I think it was on the west side. Anyway, he used to be an intern at Charlie Trotter's at the time. Jeffrey Benson was his name. And so he said, like, I didn't have a room to stay in. So I was just like, hey, can I crash in your room till I find something? But I had to start working already. Long story short, I will never forget this. I asked for a cab. I mean, I hailed a cab. And I think he didn't correctly understand me. He thought it's 85th Street, not 185th Street. And then we drove up Columbus Circle, and in Columbus Circle they stopped, get out. So I had to get out. He didn't want me to go up there.
Yeah.
So I was standing there again in the middle of Columbus Circle with all my belongings, and somebody helped, and brought me up there. But that was sort of the startup stories. And obviously, when you started working for Gordon at the time, I mean, it was like, you know, nonstop. There was no time to look for apartments, this and this. It took me about 2 to 3 weeks actually to get a room because I had no chance to look. But all that aside, it was a great team too. There's a lot of great people came out of this kitchen, even if the kitchen didn't get that credit at that time. But, you know, Rampa Brocchi from Gotham Bar and Grill. I mean, there's the pastry chefs left and right. I mean, that was good people working.
Yeah, that's great. So 7 years. What about when you first had a chance, when you took over that place? How long did it take you to find your own voice, right? Like, after spending... You worked for some pretty strong personalities with very defined styles, right? Did you, over the years you were doing that, did you have a notebook where you kept sort of your own ideas?
Yeah.
Like when you became the chef, right? Did you have a menu that you'd been kind of working on off privately that was sort of you were ready to give a shot?
Yeah, I think every chef has it some sort of in the back pocket. Some dishes, you know, you adjust like every couple of weeks you can open it again. So like, okay, this was actually not that great of an idea, but you know, we can fix that. So I did that. But at Gordon Ramsay, I was not able to put my own menu. It was my own menu, but at the same time, I had to sort of feel it out because Gordon Ramsay's name was on the door, and it's when the name is on the door, it's
that's what it is. You had to stay in that lane.
To stay in this lane, and that was not the easy part for me as well because, you know, you cannot go too Asian, you cannot do this because this style was very, like, French-orientated.
Yeah.
So it was a good learning curve, but, you know, to stay consistent and to pull off 80 cooks on the back there and do that in a union environment as well on top of it, to make this a little bit
more
challenging.
That's a whole other interview.
exactly. But, you know, I have never experienced anything like this, the management style in New York City, the union, the style of volume as well. You have to look at this too. I mean, the volume was insane.
Yeah.
So to get everything under one umbrella was management-wise very, very challenging. Yeah. And at that point, there was cooking is one thing, but if you get the cooking part, creativity, motivation, inspiration together in an environment like this, that was the biggest challenge.
This episode is brought to you by Tillet, the style leader in hotel and restaurant uniforms. Tillet is redefining workwear for the hospitality industry, ensuring that you and your team feel great from stove to street. Tillet is a full line of workwear clothing from pants to work shirts, chef aprons, jackets, dresses, chef coats, and more, with over 95% of their garments produced in the USA. Each hotel and chefwear collection is timed with the seasons, comprised of exceptional functional fabrics and built to last. Custom uniforms can be tailored for your restaurant, hotel, or store. Learn more at tillitnyc.com. That's T-I-L-I-T-N-Y-C.com.
I hope you're enjoying this podcast. And you know, Heritage Radio Network has thousands more. Hi, my name is Linda Palacio, and I'm the host on A Taste of the Past here on HRN. Join us on a weekly journey through culinary history, where we explore the when, where, what, and why of food throughout history. You can find A Taste of the Past wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. I'm going to get you to the rest of my interview with Chef Marcus Glocker in just a moment. But first, I do want to remind people that I would love if you followed the show on Instagram. The handle is at Chef Podcast. I would also love if you subscribe to the show. Jose, how do you follow? Do you subscribe?
I subscribe on Stitcher.
Stitcher.
I have Stitcher because I don't have an iPhone.
Yep. Have you reviewed the show?
You know, I don't want to sit here and tell you, you know. I'll tell you this. I feel really guilty that I haven't. I don't know what it is after I sent you that email. I was like, oh.
What more do I have to do to get a review from somebody?
There was something about it. I was like, I think Andrew's going to bring this up. And then I had all the time in the world and I just haven't.
No, it's okay. It's just my life's blood. Yeah. It's okay.
Stop.
No. Anyway, I would love if you reviewed the show on iTunes or Stitcher. You can actually do a review. You really should subscribe. I do still know people who they follow us on Instagram, which is great. We do announce things that are like live shows and whatnot. But if you subscribe, it just shows up in your queue.
Yep.
It's free. And, you know,
you're always showing up.
I was Wednesday on the way here. Yeah, every Wednesday afternoon it just pops up. And it's totally free. Anyway, that's all I want to say about that. And I do also want to remind people that coming up in just about a month now is the first ever Food Media Lab.
Nice.
In San Francisco. I've talked about it before. I'm not going to say too much today, but it is 3 days of talks, classes, group workshops. A lot of the biggest names in food media are going to be there teaching. There's going to be modules on podcasting, on photography, on books, on article writing, on marketing yourself.
How excited are you about that one?
Here's why I'm really excited about it. I love talking to young aspiring writers and podcasters now. I'm always happy to give people advice. And the spirit of this thing is that those of us who are, I don't know when I found myself in this side of the age fence, but those of
you
us
look
who,
young.
Thank you. Okay. Those of us who are more mature are really there to kind of you know, convey what we know and have learned, and a lot of times have learned through a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. to younger people. And there are, you know, throughout the 3 days, in addition to these classes, there's going to be, you know, like, I hate that it sounds very mercenary, but like, you know, networking sessions. Yeah. And people, plenty of people, I'm sure, will come away with my contact info. And if I can help them over the coming months and years, I will.
Well, that's awesome that you give back. It's like giving back.
But the other thing is, on the middle Tuesday, or the middle day of the conference, which is a Tuesday, I'm going to be doing a live show, live Andrew Talks to Chefs. Okay. If you have a ticket to the Food Media Lab, you're automatically get a ticket to the live recording, or people can just buy a ticket to that recording. But it's from 7 to 9 p.m. I'm interviewing Chef Preeti Mistry, which I expect will be great. That's going to be a one-on-one discussion. And then we're going to have five current and former members of the Zuni Cafe team are going to be there to memorialize and talk about the late chef Judy Rogers. And that I expect to be terrific. It's the 40th anniversary of the restaurant this year. And Judy was an amazing chef and also an amazing cookbook writer. And anyway, I've said
a lot of anniversaries, it seems.
Yeah, a lot of stuff this year. Yeah. Anyway, with that, I'm going to now send it back to the rest of my interview with Chef Marcus Glocker, recorded a few weeks ago in the morning at Batard Restaurant in the Tribeca neighborhood of New York City. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. This project here, Batard, it's you, John Winterman, and Drew Naporant.
Correct.
John and you had Charlie Trotter in common.
Correct.
Yeah. How did you two first connect, and how did you first start to conceive of what you guys wanted to do together?
I mean, Giuseppe Tantori, he was in Charlie Trotter's.
Yep.
I'm sure you know him from Boca Restaurant Group in Chicago. So he sort of introduced us at that point when I came to New York. And, you know, we went out after work and had a chat and stuff. So we both worked in high-end places. I mean, Danielle, I think it's the fine dining restaurant in the city for me. So we wanted to do great food, but, you know, we always talked about having a little bit more casual and, like, get rid of the tablecloth and that type of thing. I think there was the movement in general anyway, but I just wanted to not lose the touch on the food side of it and the wine side, because that both can be great, but have the front of house like really relaxing and give the people what they want, as Drew Naporant always says. So, so I had a business plan in my pocket. I had the menu in my pocket, as we just talked about.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you know, I left Gordon Ramsay. I traveled America a little bit, you know, to my West Coast thing, and you know, and I came back here. And actually, Marcus Truxler, a dear friend of mine as well, he said, like, you know, why not looking at 239 West Broadway space?
Just Marcus Truxler was an alumnus of the Daniel
Boulud.
Yes,
yeah, absolutely.
He was. People who dined there several years back would remember him as super nice, great guy.
Yeah, the 007 of Austria.
The 007 of Austria. Okay.
No, he's great. So he put me in touch with Drew, and obviously I knew Drew anyway. So I presented this to him, and I think Drew had sort of a similar idea to do something more casual here again, to sort of have the flair of Montfrechet coming back as well. There was Cotone, which was fantastic, you know, but it was like a 2-star restaurant, high end. And we wanted to do it a notch below to say, you know, it's a little bit more casual, but, you know, still using the same ingredients and the same techniques, but a little bit more casual. So we proposed this to Drew, and it worked out.
The rest is history.
The rest is history.
Can you speak to what it's like to come, if it affects you at all, this space, for people who know the history of New York dining over the last 40 years or so, this is the space that was Montrachet, you just mentioned it. That's where David Boulay got famous.
Absolutely.
Drew's been the consistent thing. It's, you know, Drew has the space. He was the restaurateur. And then a number of other chefs were here while it was still Montrachet. And then, as you said, Lee Brandt was here with Cortone. The consistency, you know, Drew's been very cute with the names. You know, it's always a wine region, right? Smart. But this is a space with a lot of history. Does that affect you at all? Because it has gone through a redesign each time, right? So it's not like it's not. It is a different restaurant, but it's also a space that's kind of
iconic.
Iconic, hallowed. I mean, it's as iconic as it gets, really, in this town.
You know, it would always be Montrachet for Drew. It would always be Batard for me. You know,
you think it'll always be Montrachet for Drew?
I think
that's
his I mean, it's his first restaurant. I mean, it's a big thing. I mean, that's how his career started, I think. And that's huge. I mean, there's some ties and history to it. We have still guests from Montrachet coming in here, you know, and they say, oh, the kitchen was on the left side and this and this and that. So this will always be around, and that's the history. But I think that's great, though, in the same time. Taking over from Cotone was big shoes to fill as well. You know, it's two Michelin stars, you know, that kind of dining. I mean, Paul is a phenomenal chef. So there was definitely something, how can you find your own identity? What do you do after all these chefs cooking here and after all these sommeliers and wine people and, you know, the history of this place? So how can you make a mark with what you do? I think we got lucky.
What do you mean?
We got lucky. I mean,
you mean just everything fell in place.
I think it was the right time as well for that kind of dining, for that kind of feel of a dining room.
Yeah.
And most importantly, I think it wasn't pretentious at all when we did it. I mean, to have a wine list like this, you easily can fall into the, you know, pretentious side of a restaurant. But the way we presented this wine list and the way we handled ourselves in front of house as well was not pretentious, and it was easy, and it was an easy access, and people come in here and have like two courses and, you know, leave. If they want to spend more money, they can, but they don't have to. So that sort of at that time when we opened, I think it was a great move.
Well, it's interesting. It's for people who have the background that you all have, right, in terms of where you worked, just right at that basic level, I'm not going to say that those places are pretentious, but they're very formal, exacting in some ways, serious. They're serious places, right? And what you do in the back of the house here is serious. What John brings to the front of the house is serious.
Absolutely.
But you guys, I don't know you as well as I know John, and I don't even know him that well, but, you know, Drew Naporant is as unpretentious as it comes, right? John seems to have a real sense of humor. You know, if you look at his social media, if you've ever talked to him. So you guys, and I've gotten to know you just a little bit. We were at lunch together at the holidays. But you guys don't seem to take yourselves too seriously. There's a difference. You take your work very seriously. But so I think what you're speaking to is there's a little bit of a sense of humor, subtle.
Absolutely.
But it affects things. People don't want to eat in these. I mean, it's just a fact right now. People are not looking for a stuffy dining situation for the most part.
I fully agree. And I think on the chef's side, if you would have asked me 10 years ago, I would have answered this question completely different, because I probably would have, if you walk in the door 10 years ago and I would be chef here, I probably would give you 10 courses and like we'll send you out an explanation for every course and, you know, possibly put as many ingredients on the plate as I can to show you how good or how bad of a cook I am.
Mm-hmm.
But now, for me, it's not just the cooking part of it. For me, it's the restaurant, which I enjoy about New York. It's like, let's get back to the idea of a restaurant. And what's the idea of a restaurant? That people feel well, that people can speak to their, you know, dining companion, that they, it's not all about the chef. It's not all about the sommelier. But with still having the quality on the plate and the wine in the glass. So when you realize this is a chef and then you have friends or people they want to check out the restaurant coming into your restaurant, and you're going to hold back actually a little bit in terms of like, don't give him like three extra dishes. Don't give him like all these things around just to appreciate that they're here. Sometimes you're going the wrong way. You're overdoing it. And these people probably won't come back because I'm going to get three dishes or four dishes extra, which I actually don't want to eat. I don't want to do this. So this fine line to see this as a chef, when you're excited to have somebody coming in and dining with you, what are you going to do? You're going to do one thing and two things. Maybe you're going to give him a glass of wine. Maybe you're going to give him sweet wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But those things, this is exciting for me, that when the meal is finished, that the person walks out the door and is not completely, you know, overwhelmed with the whole experience. And that's sort of, I truly believe that that's when the chef realizes what's going on in the restaurant as well. And maybe you should step out in the dining room sometimes and see what's going on, because most of the times you see in the face expression already of the guest if they are, you know, too full or, you know, it's too much or...
Yeah, well, as you know, I was very delinquent in getting in here.
No.
And I came in, I think, just last December with my wife. John was here. You came, but it was, you know, it was a quick visit that everyone kind of let me and my wife have dinner. And it was one of the best meals I had last year. I had such a great time, and the food was just tremendous. How do you define your own style, or do you not like to do that?
I mean, it's very hard to define your own style these days because it's just too much influence, I think, all over the place with Instagram and everything. But I do have my own style. I do have my flavor profile, I would say, is very distinctive since, you know, I like to have like pungent flavors. I like to season to the edge.
Season to the edge.
I do like that, and I like to balance it out with the right amount of acid. Those things, I do that. For me, it's for some people maybe it's a little bit too intense. Sometimes too salty maybe, but I think there is something about even French food as well. It has to be seasoned to the edge. Has to be the right amount of acid.
What do you mean by? I'm sorry to interrupt. Seasoned to the edge. No one's ever used that term with me, but I kind of love it. I think I know what it means.
There's a very short line of like, you know, it's going to be too salty or it's going to be boring. And these two in between for me is a very important thing. It's even for a sauce, you know, when I worked for Eckert Witzigmann in Germany, a sauce for him was always like the vehicle of flavor. And now it's sort of the protein is sort of the vehicle of flavor with the right amount of seasoning. And the sauce is sort of just an afterthought, most of the time, an afterthought. And it's sort of to keep the dish moist and together. But the seasoning for me for sauce is just like, has to be the sweetness, the saltiness, the balance of acid to smooth the whole three item or elements out. That's sort of the seasoning on the edge for me. If it's not done correctly, you have the sauce. It's great, it tastes good. There's something missing, there's the pep.
It doesn't pop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is something I really...
I kind of love that. I love that expression. I mean, I know what you mean. It's making it, I mean, this is a visual word, but making it as vivid as you can without going over into overkill.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, and maintaining balance.
Yeah. And then when you have the wine, I mean, you need to know your wine as well as a chef. So when those two things, especially for wine dinners, come together, you need to approach it a little bit different. You cannot just say, okay, we're going to do this dish with that, and that's it. You have to know how the wine tastes, and maybe you're going to need a little bit more of the acid, a little bit more of the sweetness. Yeah.
If you were to take your, let's say you took some of the classic dishes that you do, but you execute them in, you know, to your taste, right? And you went back home to the hotel where you worked as a kid, would it register there, do you think, as overly aggressive, or would it be within the realm of...
Yeah,
does that question make sense?
It makes sense. I think it would technically feel familiar or taste familiar for many, many people. But at the same time, the way I use the ingredients, they would never agree that really traditional Austrian cooking, because that's just how it is.
Yeah.
But a beef bouillon, for example, or like a chicken consommé. For me, a chicken noodle soup, for example, for me has to be seasoned as well.
It
cannot be too. It has to be closer to the product as well, and closer to the edge, in my opinion.
Well, it's funny. I'm drinking flat water this morning, but I usually drink sparkling water, seltzer water, whatever. And a million years ago, someone asked me why I did that, because you always have to pay for that, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, regular water bores my palate.
I agree with that.
It's along the lines of what you're saying, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? It's even water can have a point of distinction.
Always a classic example for me is always when I love chicken soup. I love, you know, chicken matzo ball soup. It's one of my favorite things here in New York.
Yeah.
But I never understood when you have it that there's almost no salt in there. Most of the times I eat that, I have to season it.
Yeah.
And then it's the most beautiful dish.
Yeah.
Because everything comes together.
Yeah.
But there's something about it. It's this is just not used, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's always funny. These are classic, iconic dishes. And it just needs a little bit of something, and it's just right on.
Yeah. Do you have dishes that you could think really kind of epitomize what you're about as a chef? Or do you have favorite dishes of your own?
I mean, favorite dish I don't really have. I mean, the octopus pastrami basically gave me the in here for the concept of New York as well with my background. You know, it was just the classic, the spices and everything. So it was a fun dish, and it was an Instagrammable dish as well, I would say, which was very important when we opened. But it's an old school French technique. That's all it is.
Yeah.
And the technique is, I don't know, over 100 years old probably.
Yeah.
But I just used that and tweaked it and made it my own. And that's sort of, it's not a favorite dish, but it's something, you know, I still rely on like classic techniques and flavors, which makes sense. And then you're going to tweak it.
Yeah. So do you feel like, I mean, I really do, I don't know you that well, but, you know, from everything I've read, from having met you, from having eaten your food, I do think of you as, if I had to pick classicist or non-classicist, I think of you as a classicist.
I agree, yeah.
Is it hard or even frightening today, 2019, to be someone who identifies that way? Or do you feel like I sort of feel like a lot of things are starting to come back around.
I agree.
So that gives you, you feel like this is a style you can hang in with for the long haul.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you have to go with the times and you have to be creative and then push the boundaries. I read and then, like, you know, I put those things on the plate as well, but I'm not expressing those ingredients on the plate the way other chefs might do them, you know? Not just because I don't know it or I don't want to do it. It's just as well, it has to be a style and you have to develop your own style. And when you drive a BMW and you're going to drive a Mercedes, it's the same thing. It's your style of car you want to drive. And
yes.
And I think that's, people come for certain things to certain chefs.
Yeah.
And when we globalize this whole thing about, you know, it's a great dish, everybody does the same vinaigrette, everybody does the same green and this and that, the guest, where does he go? I mean, back in the time for me, it was always nice to go. I know I went to Boulay my first time and walked through the apple room, and then I had this beautiful scallop, you know?
Yeah.
Because I wanted to have the scallop. I didn't want to have anything else. I want to have this one dish.
Yes.
And I think that's something we shouldn't forget as chefs, that your own style, if it's classic, or if it's modern, if it's molecular, whatever it might be, it doesn't matter, but it's your style, it's your...
Yes. To try to avoid the sameness.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's to me the downside of the social media era.
I fully agree.
Yeah.
Because even if you have the little icon on top and see the chef who's actually making this dish, you don't look at that. You just look at the photo, you scroll down, you see all these dishes. So you visualize all these dishes, but you don't sometimes agree or don't know where this dish is actually from.
Yeah. What's it like for you, having come up the way you've come up? It sounds from everything you're saying that you were very... You try to be very tuned to the times, right, and to be flexible. But what's it like for you hiring? Like, what kind of what do you look for? Having, because you came up again in a you talked about the way you opened here, and Drew thought you were crazy to try to do it that way. What kind of experience do you look for? How do you size up a young cook who comes to your door and tries to get a job for you?
I mean, obviously, hiring is a difficult subject these days. It's we don't have enough cooks in New York City to really feed all those restaurants.
Yeah,
And the level of cooks as well is very different now these days. Since maybe they know it theoretically, but you know, it takes praxis over and over and over to actually execute. So for me, the most important thing is like that they have a good attitude and they are nice human beings to have in the kitchen, and then you can mold them and you can, you know, train them the way you want them. Obviously, it takes a different cook at Augustine than it takes at Batard, but still, if they're open and willing to learn and listening, then that's half the rent for me.
Interesting. And how about, is the trail super important for you?
Trail is important for me. Yeah, I look at the knife cuts. I look at the handling in the kitchen. I look as well, like how do you talk to my team as well.
Uh-huh.
You know? Are they communicating? Are you are they interested?
Yeah.
Do they have the little notebook with them and like writing things down? You know, certain things there you see that already. That person is interested and passionate about something.
Yeah.
But if somebody's just standing in my kitchen and leaning and hope that this trail is over very soon, that's something I'm not going to appreciate.
Yeah. What's it like for you? What's it like for you having to, for the first time, unless I'm very mistaken, being chef of two places, what kind of adjustment has that been for you?
The adjustment was very hard at the beginning because, you know, I had to spend a lot of time over at Augustine to change over the menu, and which was fun. But I luckily had two of my sous chefs from here. They came with me to Augustine. And so they know me already. They know how I work, and you know they are taking charge of the menu as well.
Yeah.
And over here I have Kevin McKinley, my chef de cuisine, who is amazing guy. Worked at Gotham Bar and Grill before. He knows.
Oh, is that where he came from?
Yeah, he came from.
Oh, I didn't
Gotham
know that.
Bar and Grill.
Okay.
You know, he's very passionate about bread. He's very passionate about, like, I mean, even from the seasoning perspective, when I taste something from him, it's very close to what I like. And then, talking about seasoning to the edge, he enjoys it too, like, you know, that it pops. So it's not all about the looks on the dish, it's about the flavors as well, and Kevin is doing a fantastic job there. So it was fairly easy for me to go back and forth. However, you know, menu development, new dishes. We're going to taste them. We're going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But that I'm here day to day. These guys are in mm-hmm. charge of the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
They are cooking. They are observing. They making sure things are right.
Mm-hmm. You enjoying this moment? You seem very happy when I see
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I do enjoy that. I think what I really enjoy about that whole aspect of it is that I have two different distinctive kitchens, you know, and it's maybe we use a few recipes, they're the same, but in general, it's a classic approach of food I did probably on a mountain back home.
Okay,
right. Pork, you know?
Right.
And over here, I do a beautiful Touchon, and
So you have two different outlets for two different parts of your personality.
And I enjoy both type of cuisines.
Yeah, it's great. All right. Well, it's good. This is the longest conversation we've ever had. So
true.
I'm glad we did this. Thanks for making the time at the beginning of your week.
Thanks so much.
See you soon.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Jose Arroyo. Thank you. Did I do better?
That was better.
Thank you.
That was good.
It's in there. I grew up in Miami.
You get a pass.
It's in there.
I
got to get it back. Give me a day, I could nail it.
I had someone that called me Oreo for a long time.
What?
One of my military friends.
But did they think that was how it was pronounced?
They were like, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to go this way. I'm like, all right.
Okay. As long as you're okay with it.
She was nice.
Okay. As long as you're okay with it.
Yeah.
Jose, thank you.
Thank you. Thank
I appreciate you,
you
doing the intro with me, and your note was great, and I'm glad we got an interview in. Other people out there will hear more about this on the show with Jose, but I do welcome people. I just ask that you're honest with yourself. If you're a good talker and you got a good story and you think it's unique and you have something to share and you don't mind being asked a lot of personal questions, shoot me a note. You never know.
Come on down.
You could find yourself on a bench in Santa Monica an interview.
Yeah, you know. If I had a cocktail, that would only make it better, but that's okay.
Marcus Glocker, thanks for interviewing with me. Jeet Paul, our engineer, thank you as always for what you do. To everyone at Heritage, thank you for your support. And to everyone out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we will see you back here in a week on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrations happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.